The Akkad and Kokai Report, episode number 47.
Welcome to the Akkad and Kokai Report, the podcast dedicated to making sense of healthcare, from policy to economics, from evidence-based medicine to ethics. Join us as Drs. Michelle Akkad and Anish Kokai diagnose and treat the latest epidemic of healthcare absurdities.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us on this episode of the Akkad and Kokai Report. Before we get started, a quick request. We have managed to produce more than 40 episodes of the Akkad and Kokai Report by now and have wasted countless hours of your productive time, but we would like to do it better. We need your feedback about what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong, etc. So please drop a comment either on iTunes, on the show notes, or on our Facebook page, all of which you can access at akkadandkokai.com. So today we are pleased to have as our guest a physician who is also a mathematician, an inventor, and a philosopher committed to bringing better ideas to the world of pharmacology. And despite his technical and computational inclinations, our guest's ideas are meant not to mindlessly treat patients like numbers, but on the contrary, to focus clinical research on the individual person at hand. His consulting firm is Precision Methodologies, and its tagline is, "One size does not fit all." David Norris, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Michelle. Good to be with you and Anish.
Yes, we're delighted to have you. David, I want to set the stage for what we're going to talk about as best as I can for the audience, the way I understand it. So drugs are being tested and approved on the basis of a certain testing protocol. Mm-hmm. You think that testing protocol is not that good, and you have a better idea. Is that the gist of it?
Sure, that's a great start.
All right. Okay. So describe to us what the standard testing protocol, and perhaps we should say that we should focus on oncology drugs, cancer drugs, as opposed to other drugs, or is it the same for everything?
Yeah. So you know that's actually a great way to begin. Why this focus on oncology in particular? So this practice of one size fits all dose finding, which occurs in phase one trials of our phase one, two, three drug development process, is ubiquitous and it's done for many drugs. The reason that I've focused on this practice in oncology specifically is that the phase one trial in oncology has some special ethical characteristics that lend themselves to a dose individualization perspective. Perhaps I could start by just sort of telling the story of how I stumbled on dose individualization as a problem. I think that's
sure.
That
sure, but at some point, I want to make sure you describe what the current dose dosing protocol is.
Yeah.
So you want to do this? Either way, either now or after you describe how you stumbled.
Sure. Yeah, but yeah. No, go ahead and tell us how right now what's the process to
great. That's a great way to start. So in our drug development process, we have typically it's described as three phases: phase one, phase two, and phase three. These phase three trials are the so-called registration trials that they're the ones you typically hear about in the media, because these are the trials that typically lead to a registration. The FDA or other regulatory authorities use these phase three trials to designate drugs as a marketable. And it's the phase three trial that really is usually stands as the barrier between an experimental therapy and a marketed therapy. Preceding those phase three trials, though, is some preliminary work. As you can imagine, one of the first things you'd like to do as you are investigating a drug is find out what doses are appropriate. And this is in fact what's done in these phase one trials, where the aim is to find, and unfortunately now, a single dose that is supposed to carry forward into the phase two. And this is called the recommended phase two dose. And then in the phase two trials, you begin looking typically for signals of efficacy of the drug. After you've found a level that that is in a phase one trial that is tolerable.
Okay, so phase one trial, you try to identify the dose that, you know, the highest dose possible that doesn't have, you know, terrible side effects, you know, something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And then phase two trial, you test that a little bit longer or on more people to see what kind of problem you get into and what kind of, and if you have a signal of efficacy. Is that roughly?
And in the phase one trials, typically how many patients are in phase one trials that you're trying to find? That you're looking for safety and lethality and whatnot?
So often we're talking about dozens of patients. You know, you're talking about 24 patients or more in a typical phase one trial.
Okay. And in that, do all those patients get the same dose?
Typically what's done is a dose escalation procedure is carried out. And here's how that works. You decide before you do the study that there is some range of doses that you want to explore. And they go from a low dose that you think is probably pretty safe. That would be the first dose that's given to a human, possibly. These are called first in human trials. And then you'd have a series of escalating doses up to some maximum that you think you might want to trial. And typically what you do is you enroll a few patients in a cohort who receive that lowest dose. And provided that there are a few adverse effects, you might then enroll another group of patients in the next higher dose. Okay. And you continue in this way, dosing the drug, assessing adverse effects, and escalating as indicated by the toxicity assessment.
So what in this protocol is mandated by the FDA, and what is, you know, sort of tradition or habits that pharmaceutical companies have of doing things?
Yeah, I think, as far as what is mandated by the FDA, little about this process is constrained by current mandates. I mean, certainly there are some examples of innovative, truly innovative phase one trials that depart from that pattern. I think that by and large, these escalation procedures that I am criticizing arise more from the tradition than because they are demanded on a regulatory basis.
All right. And so at the end of that process, there is typically a single dose that is then agreed upon by the investigators, and that will move forward into the subsequent phases.
Typically, yeah. Some years ago, a term like dose ranging was used, and there was some thinking and some hope, and really I'm talking about the 1990s, that one might preserve a dose range to carry forward for further refinement. But I think that is, that's just typically not done anymore. And really the target almost always is a single recommended phase two dose.
Okay. So how did you stumble on this this opportunity for you, this opportunity to improve things?
Yeah. So, it turns out that back in 2015 or so, most of my consulting was actually late phase stuff, pharmacoepidemiology, pharmacoeconomics. And I just happened to be attending a Bayesian a Bayesian conference in 2015 in Switzerland, where there was a short course that was taught before the conference opened on dose finding. And having back in medical school actually done a little bit of research about a dose titration for tacrolimus in the immediate post-transplant stage after kidney transplant, I thought, oh gosh, dose finding, that sounds like something I've done before. This sounds interesting. And I discovered, really to my shock, that despite the fact that this was a Bayesian approach, right, and Bayesianism is with its learn-as-you-go spirit, seems to me, ideally adapted to learning and adjusting your notion of dose, also also well adapted to dose individualization, which is of course what you would expect, you know, coming at this from an MD's perspective. And nevertheless, although the methods that were used were technically Bayesian, the underlying spirit was very much frequentist, and the target dose was actually defined by a target toxicity level. The aim was to find a dose that causes an intolerable toxicity in some given fraction of the patients who receive the drug, you know, 1/3 or 25%. So this was, you know, really quite jarring to me. And when I had an opportunity later that same year to attend another short course on dose finding at the JSM, you know, the annual joint statistical meetings, I took that as well. And here again, I was faced with this same shock that, and here now, there was even a pharmacometrics kind of perspective present in the work that was presented there. And you know, pharmacometricians, these are the pharmacologists who are keen on models and not afraid to model compartmental pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics of drugs. Nevertheless, even with that attitude that should have admitted model-based thinking, right, which again, to my intuition, would have been essential to individualizing dose. Nevertheless, the same procedure, even though it was technically quite different, the same overarching process was undertaken, where you attempt to find a single dose that will cause an intolerable toxicity in some given fraction of patients. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So having seen this twice, I was still quite shocked. And it took me about a year of further research to really admit to myself that things were as bad as I thought they were, and that this truly was a ubiquitous practice. I then used the 2016 JSM conference to verify that in fact nobody was doing dose individualization in phase.
JSM is?
Oh, that's the Joint Statistical Meetings, which is the big annual meeting of statisticians in the United States every year.
All right. Very good.
Yeah. And so at that point, starting from JSM 2016, I began working on this problem, published my first paper early in 2017, and have continued to roll out a series of different dimensional outlooks on the problem.
That sounds great. So tell us what, you have a finished product now, pretty much?
Yeah, very much. So the framework that I'm advocating here as a solution to this problem is called dose titration algorithm tuning, or DTAT.
Okay.
And it works basically like this. It replaces dose finding, the process of finding a single dose, with the process of learning, not finding, a dose titration algorithm. That is, what you need to learn is, how do I titrate this drug to an appropriate level for a given patient? All right. So, and methodologically, in terms of the technique, you're using something that is at least inspired by recursive filtering, which is an idea from statistics. Most people know it, are familiar with it through the Kalman filter. It's an idea from statistics that's very Bayesian in spirit. You start with a guess about the initial dose, and you give that dose, and you check for a toxicity, and then you adjust the dose based on a model that you have of the pharmacology and the pharmacodynamics and the toxicity, the dose toxicity curve, and you repeat this recursively. And it's of course a process that's familiar to any physician who has started a new diabetic on metformin and then maybe accelerated or intensified therapy through a number of other drugs, or again, for you cardiologists, treating a patient for hypertension is very much the same sort of process, right? You start with a low dose, and in order to avoid the orthostatic hypotension in the falls, right? And you follow up the clinical the findings, you know, the blood pressure in the office, and you modify the dose as time goes on.
Right. So presumably, your protocol then would stay with the subject if we're still in the trials phases, mm-hmm. and then go on if the subject goes on to subsequent phases, right? Or what happens if you design this on a given person participating in a phase one trial, mm-hmm. right? Then you've found the dose for that particular subject. Then presumably you would use the same protocol in a phase two trial if for other subjects who enrolled in phase two and phase three trials, so that each patient in that trial will have a specific dose given to them. Is that the idea?
Yes, very much so. And but here's where the final T of DTaT comes in. It's the idea of tuning. You know, the Kalman filter, when it was introduced in the 1960s, was first used actually as a means to it's one of the most important pieces of applied mathematics from the 20th century. You know, it stands on par with the fast Fourier transform in terms of its importance. And it found application almost immediately in navigating the circumlunar motions, the circumlunar missions around the moon. Okay. And everybody who's got a GPS device in his car is familiar with the Kalman filter. It keeps a track of your current position and velocity and predicts where you're going to be in 1 second from now. And it predicts what kind of signals it's going to receive from the GPS satellites. When it gets those signals, compares what it predicted they would be with what they actually were, and notes its error and feeds that error back into its current estimate of your velocity and position. And it does this recursively. Now, a Kalman filter can be tuned depending on how bumpy the road is, how weak the signals are from the satellites. If you're using it for controlling a vehicle, you know, it depends on how the vehicle is buffeted and so on. And here, this dose titration algorithm also has some tuning parameters that will be adjusted as time goes on. And this provides the principle that allows you to continue learning about how to find the right dose continuously throughout the whole drug development process. That dose titration algorithm may evolve so that patient number 30 gets treated with a more accurate, dose titration algorithm that, for example, might achieve the final correct dose more quickly or perhaps more safely.
Okay. But does clinical judgment come into play? In terms of deciding, you know, is this toxic enough or not toxic enough, or, you know, because you're going to feed back to the algorithm, who feeds back, right? Is there a judgment right. component of a treating physician?
Yes, very much so. And in fact, you know, I describe it even in this opening DTaT paper, you know, patients are going to be heterogeneous with respect to their pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics, but they're also heterogeneous with respect to their values and their circumstances and what they're looking for from this phase one trial. And here's where this oncology context comes into play. You know, many phase one trials in other disease processes are carried out actually in healthy volunteers. But in oncology, because of the great toxicity of oncology drugs, typically the phase one trial is performed in patients on a therapeutic basis. So the aim of the phase one trial is actually therapeutic. But certainly you might enroll a patient who at this stage, and typically this is, you know, patients enroll at a late stage in their treatment after other treatments have failed to help them, or their disease continues to progress on the best available standard therapy. You know, perhaps a patient in that situation has had enough of the adverse effects, is willing to try something new, but not willing to push the dose high.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, and there's a lovely 1997 paper. I hope you'll link for your audience.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Yeah, in which a University of Chicago English professor who was a phase one trial patient, writes an essay in which he advances his own view that he wants to be very aggressive with the intensification of his dose in his phase one trial and wants some control over that dose.
Okay.
So the heterogeneity of patients' values also plays also can be accommodated within this setting in a way that it simply can't if you are assessing DLTs according to some fixed protocol and grading them 1, 2, 3, 4.
Right, for sure. So I mean, I understand now, but which means that your algorithm eventually is also carried through into the clinic, right? I mean.
Exactly.
Once the drug is approved, then the doctors prescribing it will also go through the same kind of dose finding protocol or titration protocol with the medications. So how complicated is it for a non-statistician, you know, a clinician to apply this protocol? Is it a plug and play or?
Well, so in order to, attempts to achieve precision dosing of drugs have been frustrated for a long time, for many reasons. There's a tendency to like the idea that there's a single dose on the label which you can memorize and write down, or that you can pick from a pick list in the dreaded EHR, but achieving precision dosing is likely to require, in general, some kind of computational decision support, certainly with a drug that could be as highly toxic but also highly effective as a cancer drug, some great care and decision support, including maybe technological decision support, very much warranted.
Okay.
Probably what we will need to do is replace the dose on the label with the URL that links perhaps to
the
parameters of the dose titration algorithm.
Sure. But now another, perhaps another practical difficulty that comes to mind, that at least to me, would be what about the production of, so you'd have to have the drug comes in small sizes that you can add or, different sizes instead of having one big pill,
Yeah.
I mean, if the dose you come up with at the end is going to be, X for one person, and it's going to be Y for another person, and Z, and you have, 25 different possibilities. How do you manufacture that? Is that a problem or not too much?
Many oncology drugs are administered as infusions.
Okay.
And of course, they're infinitely divisible.
That's right. That's right.
Pace, Zeno, right? This does actually bring up quite a hairy issue that I've only really begun to think about. And that's this. If you're going to do equitable dose individualization, and if the optimal individual dose, what I call the MTDI, with that little subscript I indicating we're talking about the maximum tolerated dose for this individual, if that varies substantially across the population, then equitably individualizing dose is going to require departing now from, abandoning dollars per milligram dosing for drugs. And something like a licensing procedure now seems to be necessary. As if you're now licensing the drug to the patient in much the way that we license software on a per seat basis.
Right. I mean, I'm sure that I can't imagine the solution to that problem being that difficult. I mean, I see that it would be a departure from the traditional economics of how drugs are priced and sold in increments of milligrams and whatnot. But you're right. I mean, that would be also part of the revolution. I mean, it's not that, whatever you're doing, obviously has ripple effects, throughout the whole industry, and perhaps that makes it more challenging to advance. But I think it's terrific. I'm still trying to understand a little bit more from the clinician standpoint. I mean, let's say that now it's gone, your method has been widely accepted, and now it's in the clinic, and I'm an oncologist, and And so there's a service that I can rely on. I have a patient in front of me with a certain cancer, and I need to find out what's the best dose. Then there's a consulting service that can help me, start the process and identify the optimal dose for that given patient. Is that the idea? And we plug into, so the feedback would be not only the patient's preferences as they go along with this dose titration protocol, but also the variety or the diversity of side effects as reported by me, the clinician, to the consulting firm, right? Or to the consultant. I mean, you have to say, you have to weigh in a little bit different toxicities. I mean, if it's a toxicity that's, is expected to be transient and better tolerated as opposed to another one that seems to be more ominous, or I don't know. I mean, there seems to be, it can get a little complicated, no? I imagine. But maybe
yes. And here I would certainly hope, actually, that there wouldn't be a great deal of sort of outsourcing to the consultant, as you say, but that what you'd have delivered in the form of decision support to the treating oncologist would be something that gave real insight into the likelihood of each of several different types of major toxicities of the drug that would accompany any given dose increase. And that insight would inform the clinician in what would be a very deep conversation that the clinician is having with the patient. And the aim, I think, ultimately would be to place as much sort of power in the hands of the patient to make this decision as possible.
If it takes, how long does it take to, do you have a guess or does it depend? How long does it take 4 weeks or 6 weeks to identify the ideal dose for the patient? And if it takes a long time, is there a potential downside?
Yeah. So it certainly, the rate at which, toxicities develop and are seen depends on the drug, the class of drug, the particular drug within class that you're talking about. In the DTaP paper, by way of demonstrating a concrete application of this process, I demonstrated how a dose titration algorithm might work for docetaxel, which is this very widely used chemotherapy agent. And that's typically dosed it was every 3 weeks, let's say. And the major dose limiting toxicity there is typically neutropenia, which often develops within a week or so, within 10 days, which gives you a time, which gives you a chance to give a dose, observe the neutropenia nadir, help the patient recover, and then by the time you're giving that next dose, you know how the patient responded to that first dose. So you've acquired some new information about the state variables of the system. And you can, you can take a guess at the next dose and a better guess. And when it comes time to give the third dose, you've now been through two cycles and you've approximated the dose. In that DTaP paper, which I think was probably a fairly good, I built a model of neutropenia, of chemotherapy-induced neutropenia that came right out of the literature. All the parameters came out of the literature. And in that model, you over the course of two or three, at most four cycles, you are reaching pretty close to the optimal level.
Okay.
But this depends. There are many drugs for which late toxicities develop.
So, David, what is the? It would seem like the only folks more interested than patients, if that's possible, in terms of getting the right dose that's effective, would be pharmaceutical companies, right? Meaning, what is the resistance to finding, every individual's, ideal dose?
Yeah. So when I hear, resistance articulated, it's often in the form that that clinicians are unlikely to be, they can't be bothered to individualize dose, and that they, and that the market demands a single dose, and that the, you know, if I'm talking with people on the, you know, on the clinical development side, their concern is that commercial, you know, capital C commercial, will object to a, you know, a drug which, for which the label is planned to be a URL rather than a single, you know, rather than a single number.
Right. But in terms of, even before that point, I mean, in the, in terms of the clinical research aspect of things, a phase three trial, if it incorporated that information, I mean, presumably would be to the advantage of the pharmaceutical company to have that kind of precision for dosing, because then it would enhance the chance that more of the enrollees in the treatment arm would have, you know, a more effective dose with that sort of thing. No, so what kind of feedback are you getting there?
So one of the very first things I did after rolling out the initial DTaP paper was to pursue a pharmacoeconomic argument along exactly these lines, in which I compare one-size-fits-all dosing against individualized dosing, under the assumption that the individually optimal dose is distributed in some way in the population with a, you know, a coefficient of variation. A non-zero coefficient of variation. And it turns out that for what are probably quite natural and reasonable coefficients of variation, that when you replace individually optimal doses with one-size-fits-all dosing, even if that's optimal one-size-fits-all dosing, right? I'm not even talking about the kind of dosing that you get from the actual trials that we're doing now. You might lose something like half of the social value of the drug, which, you know, in theory translates into a loss of half of the profit.
Right.
Or at least half of the at least half of the value of the drug.
Yeah. Right. So I mean, it's such a competitive environment in the pharmaceutical industry. It seems somewhat flabbergasting that there isn't that folks wouldn't at least try this in, you know, a variety of different places. I mean, and it's not just oncology, right? It's like this whole the fish oil. I don't know if you're following the fish oil.
Oh gosh, saga. No. You
know, the fish oil saga has been that, you know, first fish oils were good because, you know, bears apparently live till they're 125. I made that up. Fish oils are supposedly good because, you know, omega-3 fat, salmon, etc. And then, you know, all these trials came out and a lot of the RCTs were negative. And then finally, the most recent trial with 4 grams, which is the most amount of fish oil, purified eicosapent pentanoic acid, is highly purified, 4 grams a day. That has done the trick. And now we're seeing cardiovascular event rate reduction, right? So, but of course, there's been thousands and thousands of patients, I think, in these trials until finally somebody was like, well, I think it's, you have to do 4 grams a day, you know? So, I mean, you know, so break it down for us dumb cardiologists, as you have done a couple of times before, but would the ideal, I guess cancer is different perhaps because you can see some of the lethality or some of the side effects relatively shortly, whereas how would you apply this to just drug development in general, in terms of, say, you know, take fish oil as an example. Like, you know, obviously these drug companies spent a lot of money on negative trials, and now finally it seems like the 4 gram dose is what's working, but maybe there are patients where 5 or 6 grams is what's needed to work.
I don't actually necessarily think that DTaP and dose individualization I don't think that these concepts engage so easily in a setting like this, where, you know, probably you're talking about
long-term,
relatively modest efficacy. And, you know, some of the drugs that we're talking about here are tremendously efficacious. We're not doing the kind of population medicine that Michel has
railed against,
dismantled so violently. we're talking about drugs that are at the same time, highly toxic but also highly effective, and it's where you have that intense balance that that I think a principal quintet engages. And then also, I think you do have to, you can't really learn about the right dose any faster than the toxicities and the beneficial effects accrue.
Right. That makes sense. That makes sense. So, David, we touched a little bit on the patient side of things, but I heard you speak, on Raphael's program recently. There's definitely an ethical dimension to this problem that you're hoping perhaps to, I wouldn't say capitalize on, but at least right. Tell us about that. I mean, in what way this sort of what's the ethical dimension of this the current state of affairs?
Yeah. So this has actually been one of the sort of interesting surprises, interesting things to reflect back on about this process, is that starting from from this ethical motivation, starting from this shock that we're not individualizing the dose, and it's shocking because one has an allegiance to the individual patient. The beginning from that first principle can be so fruitful, and I hope that this is a lesson that people will draw generically from this work, even after it sort of finds its way into practice. There is a particular and ethical principle that I discovered really about a year after the DTET paper, which gives I think special force to special effective force to my argument. And here's what it is. I described for you this process of a dose escalation trial. You decide you've got doses 1 through 6, and you start, since this is a first in human trial, you start people on dose number 1, and you give that dose to a few people. Often it's 3 people, and if they don't have bad effects, then you decide you're going to escalate, which means you're going to try dose number 2, dose level 2. And here's what's done. Typically, you give dose number 2 to a newly enrolled patient in the trial. So this is a drug naive patient, and you're enrolling this patient at dose level 2, whereas let's say the first 3 patients in your trial are continuing on dose level 1.
I see.
So that moment when you take a drug naive patient and give dose level 2, while 3 individuals are still maybe languishing at a subtherapeutic dose level 1, that violates what I a concept I develop as what precautionary coherence. You failed to take the necessary precaution, recognizing that pharmacokinetics and dynamics are heterogeneous. What you ought to have done, of course, is to bump up one of those first 3 patients into dose level 2 while enrolling the 4th patient at dose level 1, because he or she is drug naive.
Right. I mean, I suppose that's certainly is one way of doing it. But no matter what, I mean, I think the, at least if I understand it correctly, currently the people at dose number 1 who stay there don't have any show, and they may not know when they enroll. And I mean, they may know that they are the first ones, but they may not understand fully the implication of what that means.
This and there's a phrase that you often see when you read enough phase 1 trial reports, is the intra-patient dose escalation was not allowed. I mean, there's so much in that phrase there. First of all, instead of calling it titration, they call it intrapatient dose escalation to make it sound, implausible.
Right.
And yes, this has been a long-standing problem in these trials. I heard a story from a patient advocate about another patient who was in a lymphoma trial knew that she was on the lowest level dose and wanted to go up and lobbied for this, to the point of taking a flight to visit the principal investigator and was denied the opportunity to increase her dose.
Because that would, of course, throw off the established protocol and
exactly
right
exactly. But there's really no there's no excuse really for not allowing a patient who's in a phase one trial, given the context that I described earlier, where these are supposed to have therapeutic intent, there's no excuse.
Right. And there's a clear conflict of interest if, on the one hand, there's a scientific aim, even if scientifically it may not be as you've described, it's not great, because all it's at the end of that process, all you get is, a single dose for everybody.
Yeah.
But if that's the aim, then it's in conflict with the due attention to the patient as an individual, as a person, right? So
exactly.
So the consent process may be, in a way botched by that conflict of interest.
Absolutely. And that was sort of one of the surprising results of this conversation that I had about this issue. It occurred to me, and this is now 10 months after writing the DTaT paper, that it might be ethically impossible to consent a patient into a trial that violates this precautionary coherence principle. That's been another one of the wonderful surprises of doing this work, is that here I am, I think I've got the entire thing sorted out and solved from A to Z, right? And then I talk with a patient advocate and I realize that there's this entirely new dimension, new ethical dimension that had completely escaped my notice.
Right. And that's great. And that may be your strongest weapon as far as I'm concerned. I mean, potentially. What do you think?
I think so. And that's as I wrote in that THCB piece a few months ago, that is actually the tack that I'm taking now. I am, like you, a little frustrated. Oops, sorry about that. Let me turn that off so that doesn't happen again. Let's see. All right, it's not going to happen again. Where was I? I'm frustrated with the lack of uptake of what really is a open shut case made on multiple grounds. The kind of slowness of uptake has been disappointing, but I think honestly that patients and patient advocates, they're the ones with ultimately the greatest incentive, and also possibly the greatest power.
Correct. I agree.
To change here, the incentive I think is undeniable, but where their power comes in, I think, is if they're aware of this precautionary coherence principle, they're not going to want to enroll in the first cohort unless there's a clear indication that they can increase their dose as needed. If you can't enroll the first patient, you can't run that trial.
I think you're onto something. What, have you had any, have you approached, or is it too early still? I mean, sir, either patient advocacy groups or, professional societies? Or are they the professional societies? I mean, we've talked about them already on this show many times. Unfortunately, yeah. Frequently their interests lie far away from the patients they profess to defend. But nevertheless, where have you found the most positive response so far? And granted, your work is very new. I mean, if you're saying 2016, we're 2018. you know, barely 2 years of development for something that potentially threatens, you know, to change the whole way that, that things are doing. So,
yeah, it does. And I'm completely clear about that. It does make a dramatic change. And, you know, it does undermine a lot of sort of, you know, narrow personal and professional agendas. I mean, frankly, the 30 years worth of innovation in dose finding methodology really disappears as soon as you decide to individualize dosing. I've given some you know, deep thought to how the existing, you know, model-based dose finding methods might be adapted to achieve dose individualization, and I think fundamentally it's just not possible, and that those methods have to be abandoned. Of course, that's, you know, that's not good news for the people who've, you know, who built careers around those. And you know, as we've discussed, there's a certain amount of inertia in within corporations that, you know, it's almost sort of eroded my faith in capitalism, almost, as I've pursued this process. But yeah, I do, you know, I do attempt to reach out now and engage with patient advocates. The, you know, this Adonis group, which I founded over a year ago now at JSM 2017, has some committed and engaged patient advocates on board who've made, you know, great contributions. And I also, you know, enjoy reaching out actually to the patient advocacy community on Twitter. It's been uplifting actually to learn from them and engage with them. You know, you might have seen this public Twitter list of the so-called one-size-fitsologists that I've put together. And I've been able to recruit, and so what I do is, you know, it's a list of the one-size-fitsologists, these one-size-fitsall dose-finding methodologists, and I ask people to subscribe to the list by way of you know, registering a gentle protest. And a few patient advocates have actually joined and registered their protest as well. I think that protest is more powerful than you know, even the protests that some oncologists have read.
David, what are the statisticians? What has been their general reception to this?
So, I think I've won over probably one biostatistician to this view, and that's rewarding. So it's not impossible, but I think. And it's very strange, but I think that that some aspects of this DTET methodology are sort of fundamentally fundamentally rupture some prejudices that operate underneath biostatistics, and these are prejudices that prevent biostatistics from really achieving the individualization of all kinds of care. I'll tell you a story. A couple of years back, I was on an FDA webinar that was about companion diagnostics. You know, these are the tests that accompany drugs and help to, you know, help with, you know, precision dosing, for example. And the comment here was, as I was, you know, pressing a point, was that, well, come on now, you know, Dr. Norris, in the real world, we all know that precision medicine is not about the individual patient. So there's a fundamental inability to reach out to the individual because of this presumption that we need a large number of data points to learn.
Right. I can certainly, you know, I mean, in a way, it's correct that the phrase precision medicine, for the most part, refers to this, you know, huge data mining, you know, that have nothing to do with individualization of care. And I can see why, you know, much of the statistical community is sort of comfortable with this, you know, big data mining approach.
Yeah, but again, it would seem like, you know, David is providing some type of a framework for this. He's not, you know, going, this is not like intuition or, you know, he's providing an algorithm and kind of a frame, you know, whatever, a statistical framework, which, you know, should make them comfortable. So again, what do they, can you clarify what the most, I mean, you seem to be saying multiple times that it's inertia. Yeah. Is there any other substantive point? The N of one. How is this different from this N of one trial that I keep hearing about?
Oh, so the N of one trial really is it embodies the principle that I'm trying to advance.
Right. Right.
You need some kind of N greater than one, right, in order to learn something.
Right.
Biostatistics in particular, I think, tends to neglect time series statistics. My sense is that it may actually be a kind of neglected element of the biostatistics curriculum, so that the time dimension, right, that contains this recursive process that I've talked about, of giving a dose, waiting to see the result, giving another dose, all happening within an N equals one patient, but over multiple time periods. That process and the opportunities that it presents tend to be overlooked. So definitely, to the extent that that biostatistics can take on the N of one trial and make that the operative principle here, I think that provides a hook. It's by no means, you know, DTaT is by no means inaccessible to the biostatistician. I think any biostatistician who's taken a graduate level time series course will have encountered the Kalman filter, will have encountered recursive filtering, and has on board all of the, you know, technical underpinnings, all the, you know, the technical machinery to appreciate the DTaT principle. But, you know, you keep pressing me, and I probably should just say that, you know, I've tried very hard, actually, to elicit a response. I'm quite vigorous in my criticism of these one-size-fitsologists, but they won't be pinned down, and they really won't, there's not much that they can say, and so there's not much that they do say, frankly.
Right, right. And, I'm not surprised. Yeah. Have you, who wrote in favor of N equal one studies a while back? It's Dr. Eric Topol. I don't know if you were aware of that.
And, I've got an N equals
maybe
one.
You should press him on that, you know, go back to ask him if he's really serious about, you know, because he certainly is very influential.
Yeah. Well, that's a great idea. I have an N equals one or an N of one library in my Zotero, you know, enormous Zotero library. I should check if his paper's in there. If it's not,
right? I think I have it in my library. I'll give you the reference, and then you
okay,
can
great.
Nag him.
Yeah. And, you know, the more sort of influential people, you know, like Raphael and others who, you know, back this, the better. I know, you know, at least one person at FDA who has taken a liking to this idea. So it's right. Not. You know, it's not an idea that offends everyone, and it's an idea with some openings.
Correct, and I think, you know, clearly, as I said, you shouldn't. I think it should be very hopeful, and it's still very early in the stage of development of an idea, you know, so to speak. And
that's true.
I'm very encouraged. I think it's fascinating. I'm hoping that our podcast is can play a little part in. Spreading this good idea, and you know, I wish you very well. Do you have any other final things you wanted to share with the audience?
I'm so thankful that you and Ish have put me on your program. It's a real honor, actually, given the other guests that you've had. You put together just a fantastic podcast here in just a few short months. So it's a delight to join the annals of the
Pantheon.
But yeah, if I have a final thought, I'd ask people to to join me, visit my Patreon site. Actually, it's patreon.com/DTET. D-T-A-T.
We'll have that on the show notes.
All right, great. That would be great.
And your Twitter handle?
The Twitter handle is David C. Norris, MD.
Very good. And do you have a website or besides the Patreon? I mean, that's pretty much...
Yeah, I'm really posting everything on the Patreon. And, you know, okay. Nearly all of the content is... In fact, all of the content is free. The patronage concept here is really about actually demonstrating to the one-size-fits-allologists that there is a growing army of resistance.
Very good, David. We wish you very well. It's been a pleasure to hear about it and to chat with you.
Oh, thank you so much, Michel. Thank you, Anish.
Thanks for listening to the Akkad and Coca Report. Subscribe for free on iTunes or Stitcher at akkadandcoca.com, where you'll find detailed show notes, our blog, and more. akkadandcoca.com.